Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An HIV diagnosis in 1984 almost always meant a shortened life expectancy. Little was known about the virus, and there wasn't much doctors could offer patients. Today, advances in HIV medication means people with the virus are living longer. Now, almost half of all U.S. adults with HIV are 50 or older. That progress means that, for the first time, people with HIV are living longer, which brings with it another set of challenges. Allison Webel is assistant professor of nursing at Case Western Reserve University. Her research focuses on HIV self-management. She recently wrote about aging well with HIV for The Conversation. We'll post a link to her article at WOSU.org/allsides. Allison Webel joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
So first of all, can you just give us a scope of the number of people living with HIV in the U.S. and Ohio?
Sure, sure. So in the United States, we estimate there's about 1.2 million people living with HIV. That is predominantly men. So about 75% of people living with HIV in the U.S. are men, and about almost half are over the age of 50. We see very similar proportions in Ohio. We have about 23,000 people living with HIV in the United States, almost all adults, mostly men, and actually exactly 45% of Ohioans living with HIV are older than 50 years.
Are these people that have been living with it for a long time now?
Yes. So many of the people who are over the age of 50 have been living with HIV for at least a decade, if not more. There is a small proportion of people over the age of 50 who are newly diagnosed with HIV, but it tends to be a pretty small number, both in Ohio and throughout the U.S.
Is it something where the sooner you catch it, the better?
Absolutely. So the most important thing for living well with HIV is really being diagnosed as soon as possible and starting the HIV medications as quickly as you can after infection. So there are a lot of public health initiatives trying to help people who are at higher risk for becoming infected with HIV getting tested and getting them on treatment as quickly as possible.
There are a lot of different kinds of conditions and diseases that make aging more difficult than, say, what we might think of as normal. What is it about HIV that affects living older?
So HIV, there are a couple of ways of looking at this. So HIV physiologically affects a process called inflammation. So it means that we see a lot more inflammation, a lot of conditions associated with inflammation more quickly in people living with HIV that are normally associated with aging. So things like hypertension, things like cognitive dysfunction, a syndrome called frailty, meaning it's harder to move around and live a vital life. We see those a lot earlier. So in people living with HIV, so they start to develop those in their late 40s and early 50s. In kind of well-matched HIV uninfected populations, we see those developing 5 to 10 years later typically.
So when you talk about cognitive dysfunction, you're talking about dementia?
Memory loss, difficulty remembering things that you normally would be able to.
And you're saying that the sooner it's caught, the sooner you're on the medications, the less likely or the less affected you'll be by these inflammation, hypertension-related things, frailty, and cognitive dysfunction.
Absolutely. So the sooner there's actually very good evidence both in the U.S. and around the world that says the sooner we get someone on the HIV medications, the less likely they are to develop that early hypertension, that early cognitive dysfunction, and that early frailty.
Does stigma affect people aging with HIV?
Yes. So this is becoming an area of a lot more research and much more focus, because we know that people living with HIV continue to face discrimination and stigma because of their HIV disease. But we also know that there's a stigma with aging. We view older adults as a group of people who are less productive, more senile, less able to move around. And so as this group is aging, we're starting to see more and more evidence that there is this dual stigma that they're dealing with that actually can make it harder to live their lives as well as they can.
Are there stigmas about where you can live if you have HIV still?
I don't believe so. I've not seen anything recently in the literature on that, no.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about aging with HIV. There's about 1.2 million people in the United States, mostly men, and half of those are older than 50. My guest is Allison Webel. She's an assistant professor of nursing at Case Western Reserve University. She wrote about this issue for The Conversation. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment for Allison Webel, give us a call, 614-292-8255. 8513, or you can shoot us an email at allsides@wosu.org. What kind of progress has there been in HIV treatment in just the past 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, so it's actually maybe tremendous progress in HIV treatment. So the best treatment for HIV people living with HIV is that the medications now, not just have we improved kind of the quantity, so people take one pill once a day, but the quality of the medications is so much greater. They're much less toxic. There are fewer side effects, and they're much easier to take for individuals. The other kind of really big advancement in HIV medications is that there has been definitive evidence that people who are taking their medications and where you can't find the virus in their blood, they're called virally undetectable, they actually cannot transmit HIV effectively to other people. So there's a movement now called pre-exposure prophylaxis, where we try to get folks who are at risk for being infected with HIV on medications, and we work to make sure that those who are infected with HIV are virally suppressed. And those are big initiatives by federal and global public health officials to try to reduce our HIV infection rates.
I just wanted to be clear. You said there's no, I mean, the side effects from the medication is negligible, especially compared to what it was like 20 or 30 years ago. Does the medication have any effect, though, on those other related conditions, inflammation, frailty, cognitive dysfunction?
Yeah, so we know that the medications reduce the inflammation, the new medications. We're still trying to figure out, it looks like these medications do not cause as much kidney disease. They do not cause as much fat redistribution as we used to see with some of the older medications. But they're new medications, so we don't have a ton of long-term evidence on the medications that have been released in the last 5 years. So we don't know for sure how those will affect in the long term. But the side effect profile does appear to be a lot smaller, less burdensome, and some of the medications, we do know that they affect things less than they used to.
The pre-exposure prophylaxis is very exciting for a lot of reasons. Obviously, it feels almost like a cure, but are people using it? I mean, what do we know about, how easy it is to obtain it and how well it's being used?
Well, it's being used. The companies that have Gilead have a whole patient access program for folks who might not have access through their insurance to pre-exposure prophylaxis. And healthcare providers in major cities are prescribing it. They're working hard to make sure there are public awareness campaigns to make sure people are finding out where they can get PrEP, who they can talk to. There are however populations that are having a harder time accessing it. Women are actually one of these populations. So there's a big campaign in Washington, D.C. trying to reach out to women who are at very high risk of becoming infected with HIV in that city because they are not accessing PrEP. And we're seeing that in other cities as well. So women are a group that we're working very hard to try to make sure they know about PrEP, they know where to access it, and they feel comfortable accessing it.
And this is why? Why are they having a harder time?
Well, they don't know as much about it. So I think a lot of the initial trials with PrEP, a lot of the enthusiasm around PrEP was predominantly in men. Uh-huh. So we want women to know that they can access it as much and it's as valuable to them as it is to men. And there's I think it's a lot of awareness.
Mm-hmm. You tell us about Timothy Ray Brown. That's the only person known to be cured of HIV.
Yeah, so Timothy Brown was an individual who was HIV infected, who had cancer and had to get a bone marrow transplant. And in that, this is about almost 5-6 years ago now. And in that, he was they matched his bone marrow transplant to a person who was HIV negative, and they, after they transplanted, they couldn't find any more HIV in his body. And they've been repeating this now for trying to find it for many years, and they still have not been able to find any HIV in his body after the transplant. So a bone marrow transplant is a very difficult procedure to go through. It's not something we would ever want to use as a cure, but there are lessons that can be learned from that that scientists are trying to replicate to help reduce the amount of HIV in someone's body, to help develop new vaccines, or just to understand more about how we could potentially develop a cure. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, when you talk about reducing the amount of HIV in the body, so how do we visualize that? I mean, are we talking about a particle versus many particles? Are we talking about what? It's in the blood, right?
Well, it's everywhere. So HIV can hide in lots of different parts of the body. And that's actually what's made it one of the trickiest things to try to both develop a vaccine for and also to cure. Because it can go into, HIV is a virus that can go into a phase called latency, mm-hmm. where it doesn't actively reproduce itself, but it's still there. And when that latent virus is activated, it can produce more viral particles that can then kind of infect more and more of the immune cells. So it's there. It's hiding in places like our gut or other places that are really hard to get samples from. So one way that you would do this is by doing a gut biopsy, which is a kind of a hard, painful procedure, not something we would do routinely. So that's kind of what latency and the hiding of the virus is, and that's why it's been so hard to cure this disease.
You wrote about three non-pharmacological strategies, so non-drug-related, for living well with HIV. The first involves physical activity. It should be frequent.
Yes. Not just frequent, but it should be intense, and it should be a high dose of it. Now, we don't know how high of a dose of exercise or physical activity is needed, but we do know in HIV-positive adults, we've done some work here, and others have done some work that have showed that it clearly improves cardiovascular health. We know that. And we're starting to do some work where we see physical activity is improving really distressing symptoms. One of the hard things about being infected with HIV is there are lots of very burdensome symptoms that affect all aspects of someone's quality of life. So physical activity is there. There are, I think, four trials being done right now to understand the effect of physical activity on cognitive dysfunction. We've done a lot of work looking at physical activity and fatigue, and we're starting to show that, you know, increasing not just the amount of exercise, but the intensity of exercise and bringing in some resistance training can also reduce fatigue, may help things like depressive symptoms and insomnia as well.
Well, that's true for everybody, right?
We think it is. Unfortunately, the hard part of some of these trials is they don't have an HIV uninfected comparative group. But we do. The reason we say it's particularly important for this group is because they have higher frequency and higher intensity of both cognitive dysfunction and fatigue and some of the others compared to people not living with HIV. And we do know that.
A second non-drug strategy has to do with diet.
Mm-hmm. We know a lot less about diet, particularly in the current HIV era. I think a lot of the early work on diet and HIV was focused on HIV wasting when people were dying from HIV. Mm-hmm. But we do see higher rates of obesity and metabolic conditions in people living with HIV compared to people who are not living with HIV. So eating a nutrient-dense diet, again, something that we recommend for everybody, but also limiting alcohol. Now, there was a recent study that shows, in particular, limiting alcohol to very few drinks a month can actually improve mortality in people living with HIV compared to those not living with HIV. So limiting alcohol is a key strategy for improving one's diet.
And then positive social interactions. Again, all three of these things are just sound healthy anyways, but yeah. How so particularly with HIV?
Right. So people living with HIV can have increased isolation for lots of reasons. So one of the things that our team and lots of other teams have looked at is how to improve social interactions. The other hard thing is many people living with HIV, almost 70% of people living with HIV in the U.S. are unemployed. So a lot of the social interaction that people normally get through work, this population doesn't get. So trying to understand what the best types of social interactions are, and there's increasing evidence that something like paid employment, volunteering, activism can actually help to improve quality of life and reduce symptom burdens in people living with HIV.
Why such a high rate of unemployment? Is that because we're just talking about an older group of people who are retired or what?
Yeah, so it goes a little bit back to the history of HIV. So when people didn't have a long lifespan with HIV, HIV was considered a disabling diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So people who were, as soon as they were diagnosed with HIV and met certain kind of clinical thresholds, were able to be classified as disabled and go on disability SSI. So that group has not gone back to work necessarily. Mm-hmm. Some folks have, but as a group, they have not. So I think there's a lot of work being done right now within the activist community trying to figure out how to improve skills in this population and make them employable and help people find work that will also allow them to take care of their health needs.
Your research team conducted a clinical trial with HIV-positive adults to see if a group-based intervention improved exercise and that healthy eating. Did it help to do it together?
It helped partially. Mm-hmm. So what we found out was that that people living with HIV were much more interested in improving their diet, and they were actually very interested in making very simple changes to improve their diet. So what we saw was that the intervention did help to reduce weight, improve body mass index, and we found that happened mostly through reduction of sugar sweetened beverage intake. So we saw a statistically significant difference over 6 months of sugar sweetened beverage intake, which compared to the control group, which I think is actually great news considering a lot of the new evidence about the dangers of sugar and the mm-hmm. importance of reducing the intake that on everybody.
Allison Webble, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
That's Allison Webble. She's an assistant professor of nursing at Case Western Reserve University. She's talking about aging well when you've been diagnosed with HIV. You can see her article in the conversation at the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The number of people with perfect vision is decreasing. Today, more than 30% of the U.S. population is nearsighted, that is, myopic, and their numbers are expected to increase. New research suggests that for kids, spending more time outside may protect against developing myopia. Joining me in the studio is Dean at the Ohio State University College of Optometry and past president of the American Academy of Optometry, Dr. Carla Zadnick. Welcome back.
Thanks, Sam.
So more people are nearsighted.
It seems to be on the increase. So can I describe what myopia is first, since even people who are myopic may not understand what happened or how they got that way? So typically, age of onset is maybe between the ages of 8 and 12. That's when many of us who are nearsighted got our first eyeglasses. And what happens is that our eye is growing too long from the front to the back.
Okay.
So instead of light from a distant object focusing right on the back of the eye and forming a nice clear image, instead our eye keeps growing, and that image that's formed on our too long eye is now blurry. So when we put glasses or contact lenses on, or even later in life have refractive surgery, then what that does is it moves the focus back to where the retina is. It doesn't make the eye shorter, obviously. And so what we'd like to do is, gee, would there be a way to control or prevent that eye growth as we're seeing an increase in nearsightedness? Now, what we don't know is necessarily why we're seeing this increase, but certainly we want to do research that tells us how could we prevent it, or how could we even slow down the progression of nearsightedness.
I always thought nearsightedness, particularly in when you get it between the ages of 10 and or 8 and 12, as you said, I got it when I was 10, I was diagnosed, you know, I had my first pair of glasses, was a genetic thing.
So there is a genetic component. So certainly we know that if one parent is nearsighted or both parents are nearsighted, that the risk increases. But it's not absolute. So I've joked sometimes that I think things like eHarmony should have are you nearsighted or not, just in case you wanted to screen for that.
Something matters to you, yeah.
But it's not absolute. And so it certainly there is a genetic component, and like maybe most common complex diseases of today, there's an environmental component as well. And how those two factors interact is is the subject of great research.
I'm really noticing now if I'm on my phone, if I'm, you know, looking at something close up like that, not even the computer screen as much, but looking at my phone a lot, that when I then look up to watch the television or something, my eyes have a really hard time adjusting. And I think that's probably old age. But are you wondering if all that screen activity is affecting kids?
So near work, whether it's screen activity or reading, has always traditionally been a risk factor, we think, for nearsightedness. So the old picture used to be the little smart kid who would read under the covers with a flashlight when he went to bed was the kid that was going to become nearsighted. Today, that might be the little kid who's on his smartphone doing something, you know, late into the evening. And we think that's now – that's a component. But again, it doesn't explain the whole situation either. And we actually think it's less of a risk factor than this new thing we've reported, which is – get your kids outside in some decent sunlight.
Why is that?
So what's happening, and we found it's only protective against ever getting nearsighted. We've not shown that it's necessarily going to slow down that abnormal eye growth. But what we think is happening from animal work in myopia is that kids are out in the bright light outside. Doesn't matter. They could be on an iPad in the bright light outside, we think, quite honestly. And what that bright light does is it triggers a release of dopamine into the back of the eye and the retina.
Happy eyes.
And it turns out can control that eye growth. So it can actually sort of make that eye growth normal. We don't understand the biochemistry behind it yet. But it looks like it's having – so here's this – environmental factor, you're just out in the bright light with sunscreen on and all the usual protections, and yet that experience can cause that eye growth to normalize.
Any suspicions that it might have something to do with vitamin D or something like that?
Great question. So we've actually done some preliminary work on vitamin D, and we don't think it's vitamin D mediated. But that was certainly one of the things we investigated and thought maybe we could substitute for the bright light exposure with vitamin D supplementation, and we haven't really seen that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. My guest is Carla Zadnick. She is the dean of the Ohio State University College of Optometry. We're talking about pediatric eye health. But if you have any eye health questions, I squeezed in a few before we went on the air. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, about half the world's population will have myopia by 2015.
That's the really dramatic prediction that's come out. I don't know that that's necessarily true, but we do know that there is a significant problem, even inside or outside the U.S., where children and even adults are visually impaired basically for want of a pair of eyeglasses. And so that certainly is a major public health initiative, apart from preventing or slowing down myopia, that we as a world community really need to address.
When I got my glasses, I was about 10 years old, and I didn't want to get them. I didn't think I needed them. And the doctor said, oh, no, you have nearsightedness. And I didn't understand that it improved that much. And I always wondered, and I've always often wondered, is there a point where maybe don't get the glasses right away?
So there are studies that have looked at under-correction of nearsightedness.
Yeah.
The idea being that, you wear the glasses and then your eye keeps growing because it keeps heading to some set point.
Yeah.
And the under-correction study that probably won't ever be repeated turned out to result in faster progression of the myopia,
very
counterintuitive. But there are parents who think, I want to limit my child's glasses wear, or I want to have them undercorrected. And I think all you're depriving your kid of is clear vision.
Being able to see the chalkboard
exactly.
kind of a thing, or whatever screen they're looking at these days. Is there anything that you know about how much time outside makes a difference?
So I can't say, get your kid out of doors for 2 hours a day or 2.43 hours a day. Our research came as a result of the parents telling us what their children did. The range was from 2 hours a week to 14 hours a week. And I will say that what we found was there was a dose response. So more was better. But I can't say, you know, once you got to 8 hours a week, it asymptoted and it was the same after that. So we hope future studies would help give us some idea I also like to think that maybe getting your child out doing some outdoor activity and running around is probably good from a general point of view, in lots of other indicators as well.
Well, and, you know, there is a trend, luckily, back toward more recess, a little bit of a trend back. But kids are just indoors more now as a rule. It's not even a parental choice.
We all are, I think. And, you know, when I was a kid, it used to be we were outside till the mosquitoes started to bite, especially in the summer.
Yeah.
And I think that doesn't happen so much anymore. So being out of doors is something would be a relatively simple change to make. But I don't think it has to be that it's, you know, 2 or 3 hours every single day. It's not at that dosage level.
And when we're talking about sunlight, are you talking about bright sunny light or just being outside in natural light?
It looks like just being outside in natural light, because the study results came from a study done on 5,000 children over a total of a 20-year period in 5 different places in the U.S. So it wasn't all, you know, places where they were measuring it only in the summer or something.
Uh-huh.
So it's really a pretty robust effect across geography and times of year.
Some researchers have turned to low-dose atropine drops. Those are the ones that dilate the eye, that drive us all batty. They use but they've been used to successfully treat children who have early stages of myopia.
So that study is primarily out of China. There's a study where they used very low dose atropine, like 0.01%, that in fact probably wouldn't dilate the pupil or decrease near vision. And that there are ongoing studies of whether or not that can not prevent myopia, but retard its progression. So when you and I were little, if we got new glasses every year, the idea behind the low-dose atropine studies is to see if it could sort of stop that in its tracks.
Huh.
Now, you might say, what does that matter? If I've got glasses anyway, who cares how strong they are? Well, the more nearsighted you are, the longer that eyeball is. As you age, the more prone you are to things like glaucoma, macular degeneration, or retinal detachment. So it has long-term bad consequences to be more nearsighted.
I wanted to talk to you about using first, before we move on to that, is it whether or not it's possible to reverse myopia, and is that what LASIK does, or LASIK surgery? I think that's a brand name, but anyways.
So you're not necessarily reversing it. So if you imagine that it's too long of an eye,
yeah,
you're not going to shrink it.
Right.
What LASIK or any refractive surgery does is it flattens the front of the eye so that it also puts that focus where it's supposed to be. So does it... It doesn't reverse the process that resulted in it, but it corrects the vision almost in the same way that glasses or contact lenses do, by making the front of the eye less powerful.
Has that been around long enough for us to understand the long-term effects of that refractive, is that what you call it, eye?
Refractive surgery.
Refractive surgery.
I would say it has been. It's been, you know, people are now having cataract surgery who had LASIK when they were younger. And I think their experience is sort of what vision after the age of 50 when they had the refractive surgery much younger is like. And I think people are, it's an elective surgery, and I think people are still making a choice of whether that's what they want to do. But the long-term results certainly aren't showing any disasters, let's put it that way.
I was talking to somebody the other day who was telling me that their child had a cataract when they were born. And since they were very, very young, and he's only maybe 3 years old now, if that, he's been wearing a contact in one eye. And I was so surprised by that. I suppose when you started out very young in life, it's not unusual. But is there any rule of thumb about when to get children or when children can start with contacts?
Well, I think that kind of contact lens use is therapeutic
exactly.
and required. Without it, that child probably wouldn't have had normal vision in
right,
that eye.
Exactly.
And I fit children in the operating room even back in the day when I used to see patients.
Uh-huh.
But now I would say we think about prescribing contact lenses for nearsightedness, either to correct it or in some cases even possibly to slow it down.
Yeah.
I would say we can do 6, 7, 8. The children are amenable to it. If the kid's into it, especially if the parent them is also a contact lens wearer, then I think you can do it at even – you know, relatively young school ages.
And going back to that quick remark you made about slowing it down, I was actually one of those people when I wore contacts that my eyesight improved. I still hated them. I don't care. But how do you know if someone's going to respond that way to contacts?
So we actually,
and it's not every kind of contact.
That's
either.
Right. So yeah. We actually have a large clinical trial here at Ohio State that's ongoing, trying out multifocal contact lenses in children, like I would wear so that I can see at both distance and near, the equivalent of bifocal, to see whether that kind of focusing for children might be able to slow the progression of myopia. And those results, I would bet, will be available in about 18 months. So stay tuned.
Yeah.
The other contact lens option that seems to slow the progression in children is what's called overnight orthokeratology. So they wear a rigid lens. They sleep in it. During the day, they have clear vision because their front of the eye has been flattened. But we also think that might have a prevention of abnormal eye growth effect. So there's a lot of work going on
in this
area.
So you only
wear
it at night?
Only wear them at night.
And it's rigid? It seems like it'd be really uncomfortable.
So put them in, go to sleep.
Okay.
And the discomfort
And then take them out when you get
take
up.
Take them out when you get up. Vision's clear, but they also seem to all sort of retard the progression of the disease.
Okay, interesting. Well, Carla Zadnick, thank you so much for joining us. It's always great.
You are so welcome.
That's Dr. Carla Zadnick. She's dean at the OSU College of Optometry. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 40 million Americans provide a total of 37 billion hours of care per year to close relatives, aging parents, grandparents, and spouses. They're often pulling double duty, also caring for children and working full time. And too often, they're risking their financial future to come to the rescue. Behavioral scientist and bestselling author Ann Kaiser Stearns covers the issues of caregiving in her new book entitled Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. Ann Kaiser Stearns joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Of those 40 million caregivers in the U.S., more than 15 million of them provide care for someone with Alzheimer's or some other kind of dementia. When should family members sit down and talk about aging with their loved ones? Does it really change that final experience?
We need to start talking with our children while we're well. We need to talk honestly and matter-of-factly when there's not so much emotion involved. One of the things I did in my new book is I wrote a letter to my daughters at the end of the book. And basically, while I'm well, while I'm healthy, to say the things I needed to say, thanking them for the blessings of being their mom and letting it be clear that I'm grateful for the life I've had, that I trust them to take care of me, but that I don't want them to burn themselves out and suffer their own caregiving for their own children and husbands. When I'm old, I want them to take care of themselves as well as to say that I trust them to look after me.
Well, is it an either-or proposition?
In what regard?
In that I can't imagine saying, well, I'm going to take care of myself instead of my mom.
Oh, I see. You mean as we age?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that most families, when there hasn't been abuse or you haven't had extreme conflict, most of us, whatever religion we come from, or most of us just as moral people, have that thing in our head about honor your mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
I think we try to do the best we can, and we do the best we can. And if someone was abused as a child or has an extremely miserable relationship with that elder parent, they're not the one to be the caregiver,
okay,
because they are potentially at risk of abusing that elderly loved one who may have abused them when they were young.
How do you distinguish between normal aging and dementia and the early signs of dementia? How do you know?
Well, the good news is it is normal to have trouble remembering names. We have trouble when we're 20 remembering names, and that does not bespeak dementia. It is normal to leave the kitchen and go to the bedroom and forget what you went there for. It is normal to not be able to find your keys. What isn't normal is to go to the microwave that you've been using for 20 years and to not know how to use it. What isn't normal is not knowing what keys are for, or going to the grocery store where you've been at that store for 20 years and all of a sudden you don't know how to get out the store. You don't know where is the exit. So you're an accountant and you've always been good at math and you can't balance the checkbook. So it's big, those red flags are significant changes. It's not that you, and sometimes you say, like, this is my neighbor, I'm about to introduce my neighbor to a friend of mine. Oh my goodness, she's been my neighbor for 15 years, I can't remember her name.
Mm-hmm.
But you remember it in 2 hours or you remember it this evening. What is a red flag is if you can't remember who she is at all, who is that person?
Mm. You write about the stereotype threat of ageism. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a stereotype threat with racism, ageism, sexism. For instance, if you are a super bright black kid and you have a white teacher, through no fault of her own except the expectations she may have in her head, if you have a white teacher, you are three times less likely to be noticed and identified as a gifted black kid as if you had a black teacher. Well, what happens out there is there are all these invitations for ageist kinds of thinking. You have advertisements of catheters and chairlifts and medications and stereotypes of older people coming at you from various directions. Stereotype threat is if you buy into that. The tragedy is that that bright black kid might not realize I'm gifted in math and I need to be in a higher level course. The tragedy is that the older adult might say, well, I should have these aches and pains now, and start saying I'm having senior moment or I think like a dinosaur. Those are ways of buying into ageism where we talk about ourselves like we're old. And the studies show that if we buy into ageist stereotypes, we literally age more rapidly.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. And interestingly enough, if you look at the studies of stereotypical ideas of age, what you see is people who have positive age stereotypes, who expect a thriving older life, they live 7.5 years longer.
What about family members who go, oh, she's old, just let her listen and rattle on and don't, if she repeats herself, you know, a lot, don't say anything. What about that kind of,
I really believe in respect and kindness.
Uh-huh.
I love the Dalai Lama's statement about whenever possible, be kind. It is always possible. I really I grew up in Oklahoma, and I grew up with the attitude of respect for elders that basically what you see in Eastern countries of the world and Native American populations and many cultural systems, what you see is more valuing for the older adult. I think it's important that we treat people with respect. When I teach physicians, I say, you know, like with my own mother, my mother would have a 40-year-old doctor, and the doctor would call my mother Margaret, and I would say, call her Mrs. Kaiser. I want you to treat my mother with respect. I think how we treat elders really does matter, and all of us tell some of our stories over and over again, and it isn't just because you're, quote, old.
Mm-hmm. It has often been said that family caregivers are like marathon runners who run long, tough races for months and years. How should caregivers step into a long-term role? They know that there's going to be a big change. Mom's going to move or dad's going to move in with them, and they're going to be the primary caregiver.
Well, there are three things that are important. I like to say emotion, motion, and changed thinking. Emotion means connecting to other people. When you are a caregiver, There is no way you can take on all those responsibilities and all that long-term stress without taking care of yourself, and that means don't get isolated. I tell people it's really better not to quit your job so that you still have the ability to go away from the caregiving situation and where you feel good about yourself and you get a lot of contact with others. It's important to find ways to stay connected with other people as a caregiver. Next, it's so important, the motion part, exercise. Nothing is a stress buffer more than exercise. And interestingly enough, if you look at the research and you see there was a study that looked at 69-year-olds and who had healthy brains and followed them to 78, those folks who walked 30 minutes a day grew gray matter from age 69 to 78 during a 9-year period when we would be having brain shrinkage ordinarily.
Mm-hmm.
Exercise is the fountain of youth, and it is, it by the way, cuts the risk of dementia in half, and it is a tremendous stress buffer. And the third thing, if I may say quickly, is how we think. We need a sense of purpose. We need to change our thinking. It's so important to understand that those situations where our elder with Alzheimer's might accuse us of stealing and we are so offended, or they don't remember the granddaughter's name and it's so painful, if we can change the way we think about that and we can change the way we respond to the person with Alzheimer's, we can reduce the duration and severity of those kinds of behaviors on the part of the elder.
What are some of the ways people can unburden themselves? You mentioned exercise, and I get that. That's true across the board anyways.
Absolutely.
I mean, the stress, it's often considered associated with weight loss and all that kind of thing, but I think stress reduction's, you know, huge, bigger every day. But what about other ways to take time for yourself? What does that even look like?
Well, in Redefining Aging, I have 21 pages of resources. There's the Alzheimer's Association. There are .gov resources. There are many resources out there that don't even cost any money. There are also ways to have respite through memory care, where your elderly loved one might go to a memory care center 3 or 4 hours several days a week, and you'd get a respite in that way. Even if you could hire somebody for a few hours a day on a regular basis, not so you could shop groceries, but so that you could go to the movies with a friend or go to the gym or still play tennis or cards. It's so important that you find ways to get respite so that you can continue the caregiving in a way that doesn't take the toll on you emotionally and physically that it otherwise could.
How do you decide whether it's time to take mom out of independent living and not put them in assisted living but bring them home? I mean, when do you know if it's ever the right time to bring them home? Some people, that may just not work.
Well, yes, and sometimes it works the other way, where the person is at home until they must go to a nursing home. When it comes time where you're not able to take care of the person's, when you're as the child of your parent or grandparent, you're not able to change the person's diapers. You're not able to lift the person anymore to help them to turn in bed and so on. So more often it's the person is able to be in the home until they need so much physical care that nursing assistance is needed.
Caregivers are in charge of important legal documents. What do you need?
Okay. I think it's important for you not only to have a conversation repeatedly with your loved ones while you're healthy and well and younger, but to have a will. Everybody needs a will. Many of us also need a living trust, a living revocable trust. We need a power of attorney so that if we have a stroke, one of our children or another designated person can pay the mortgage or pay the medical bills. We also need a medical document that where we state what we're comfortable with. You know, if I am in a vegetative state and the physicians say I cannot recover, my brain will never be able to recover, it states exactly what you want your children or your spouse to do in terms of extraordinary means of keeping you alive. Those are really important documents. And some people find that it's important to have long-term care insurance. And if you buy that in your 50s, it locks it in at a price that's more affordable. Mm-hmm. The longer you wait for that, the more expensive it is.
People are living longer than ever before, but it means your children caretakers are older too. What have you seen in that department that's just people who are too old taking care of people who are older?
Exactly. Well, my brother and sister and I were in our 60s taking care of our parents in their 80s and 90s. And we had children, and my siblings had grandchildren. So you're often in that sandwich situation. Mm-hmm. We all just have to do the best we can. One of the things I like to say is, yes, there can be too much of a good thing. You have to be careful to not get locked into over-conscientiousness, where you are being so responsible and so concerned that you spread yourself thin and you wear yourself out and you can't sustain the long-term caregiving. I always say, as a psychologist, it's the healthy people who go for help. It's the healthy people who reach out for support. And we just have to interlock with other people in this world and let others be a participant in our caregiving. Let others be a support to us.
Why is it that mostly women, I guess 75% to 80% of caregivers are women?
Well, I think it just kind of falls to us. We're caregivers. We think of ourselves in those ways. We're nurturers from the time we have our own children. I think they see that as necessarily a bad thing, mm-hmm. except for the fact that, you know, one of the things I was telling people at Thanksgiving when families were together, hey, thank that caregiver. You need to show appreciation for that person who steps up, that woman or man in the family who's doing what they're doing. They need to hear gratitude. They need to get support as much as possible from other family members.
What about the costs of helping? Right. And how much should you feel obligated or necessary to contribute to the health and maintenance of your older parent?
Well, I think most of us would do whatever we can.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just as people are saying, don't get a second mortgage to pay for your kid to go to college because you're going to get old and where will you be then,
mm-hmm.
In that situation? I don't believe our morality requires of us that we sacrifice to such an extent that we really hurt ourselves in some significant way. But other than that, most of us are going to do the best we can with what resources we have.
Mm-hmm. And there, you list resources in your book for people who are looking for help.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Many. And it's amazing how much is out there. And we just need to not get too discouraged. You can even start with the Alzheimer's Association, for instance, and they will send you to a dozen other resources. And there are many government resources that can direct us. There are videos. There are all kinds of things to read that can be helpful. But we also can go to our church or synagogue or mosque, to our friends from work, to our grandchildren, to our neighbors. We can also ask for some help or hire a young person to spend some time with our elderly loved one, a few hours a day or several days a week, so that we get some respite.
Ann Kaiser-Stearns, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Ann Kaiser-Stearns is a professor of behavioral science at the Community College of Baltimore County. She's author of the book Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. Thanks for listening today. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.